biodegradable plastics, I'll put my biggest bet on that, especially for a country like India, because even 2 years ago, biodegradable plastics were very expensive.
Welcome to the Design Pataki podcast, a show that deconstructs the Indian and international design world with leading industry experts. I'm Isha Gupta, the founder of Design Pataki. Through our podcast, we aim to promote thoughtful and incisive conversations on design, art, and architecture. The term sustainability is shrouded in ambiguity. How do we define it? Is it a mindset we must adopt or a buzzword for brands? How does the term sustainability tie into the design and decor space? To unpack these in a myriad of other questions, we speak to a scholar on the subject, Dr. Minya Chatterjee. She has been an active torchbearer of the subject in the country. Up until 2017, she was the Chief Sustainability Officer at Jindal Steel & Power, one of India's leading business conglomerates, making her one of the youngest top businesswomen in India at the time. She's also the founder and CEO of Sustain Labs Paris, a sustainability incubator that transforms large organizations into becoming social entrepreneurs. When COVID-19 hit the country, Dr. Minya led the establishment of 11 COVID hospitals across India within 6 months by transforming existing vacant buildings. She was even acclaimed for innovations such as conceptualizing cardboard beds for patients, building COVID ambulances and mobile testing facilities within auto rickshaws. Among the numerous accolades under her belt, Dr. Minya Chatterjee was awarded Most Influential Sustainability Leader in India at the India Sustainability Leadership Summit and Awards in 2018. Hi Minya, it's a pleasure to have you here with us today and thank you for joining us.
Hi Isha, nice to see you as well. My pleasure.
And you know, you have such an interesting subject we want to talk to you about, and your expertise in this is incredible, and we're hoping we can really somehow simplify sustainability and especially sustainability in design in particular. So we're hoping that we can break it down to an ABC level at some point today.
Yeah, sure. Would love to.
So firstly, what I would want to know is what is sustainability to you? What are some of the common misconceptions that, you know, which are known around the term?
So Isha, firstly, thank you for bringing this important topic up, because like as you said, there are a lot of fads and myths and misconceptions around sustainability. And at the crux of it, I think it's about a lack of understanding of what sustainability really is. Very simply put, it is responsibility. So just as individuals, we need to be responsible towards, certain people in our lives, certain things in our life. How do you expand that sense of responsibility towards society, you know, towards a greater number of people? How do you expand that sense of responsibility and doing things right towards the ecosystem, you know, things which are nourishing you? So the plants and the animals, the water, it's really that. And I think some of the misconceptions about this is that it's more expensive to be living a life which is more responsible. And I don't know how many people would know this, but some of our traditional ways and, in the rural economy, sometimes those are the most sustainable and responsible ways of doing things. Because people in the farms, I live in a farm, you know, in Goa, and I see this, you know, on an everyday basis. Their lives are so connected and dependent on nature and things around them and the village life around them, that it makes them more responsible towards the environment and towards society and people.
I feel like that has been a general perception, especially with building. I've noticed that a lot of architects, designers, developers, they all feel that if you want to go sustainable, there's an added cost or an added budget that has to be applied to it. And which is why I would want to ask you, how would you define sustainability in a design world, in that industry per se?
So while designing a building, if you look at sustainability from a point of resource efficiency, that's an approach which makes it cheaper for the end user. So it actually makes it more affordable. So for example, if you look at landscaping, it doesn't cost you anything. You're making a colony or, you know, that's your project, you're building a colony. The way you landscape it, the trees that you plant around it, doesn't cost anything. That determines whether it's going to trap heat or not. You make, you know, right. you just make simple structures to harvest rainwater, and which can then, you know, provide water for the people who are living there. Of course, installing solar has some cost to it, but nowadays, you know, just over the last 3-4 years, it's becoming increasingly, you know, inexpensive to set up a solar, you know, panel on your rooftop. And if you look at it, some of the things, like for solar power, has a little bit of cost, and that too has become really expensive. But the other things are, right. you know, they don't cost anything. The end user, the person who's going to stay it, is actually going to pay less for the utilities, right? For the water and for the electricity.
Exactly.
And also the materials. So things like the bricks that you choose. So you could choose you know, fly ash bricks, for example. So fly ash bricks are made out of fly ash. And fly ash is a waste product from the steel industry and power industry. So, and it costs the same amount. It's just as resilient and the same properties. Similarly, cement, you know, right. cement is an amazing waste to wealth product. So when I was at JSPL, we put together a full vertical on construction, you know, construction products, and entire that business vertical on construction projects came from waste, fly ash bricks, cement, which came from, again, waste products. So I think it's just about being a bit aware also, the knowledge being there that right. it's possible to buy your bricks and cement, which is more responsibly made. And that extra effort, Isha, in this era to find that, to procure that, because I think at the times that we lived, it's not so available in India. So you just need to make sure, you need to make a little bit of effort to make sure you're buying the bricks, which is responsible. You are landscaping it well. You are making, you know, solar panels on your roof.
I think that procuring is a challenge, because I feel like one is information, lack of information. And of course, because it's not so commonly known, you're so used to a certain way of doing things that to move beyond that gets a bit tricky. So I think that's the whole idea behind doing this, is how do you find more information about, say, fly ash material per se. The other idea of what I wanted to, you know, explore with you is, you know, we hear words like green, eco-friendly, ethically sourced, fair trade, and of course, the most common, LEED certified. And I feel like every brand or every company, a lot of them use them differently. So according to you, you know, how does one navigate these words? Like, you know, it's something which gets a bit confusing on a day-to-day basis.
The elephant in the room for this discussion is data. Any company, when any product is saying that we are green, they need to talk about data. That what is your right. carbon footprint? And educational institutions need to educate schools, or even need to educate citizens to be able to understand that data. That if you're saying that this is right. my carbon footprint, even if a bottle of juice says this is my carbon footprint, what's the benchmark? Is that high? Is that low? What goes into calculating it? LEEDs and all these other, you know, green building certifications, it's okay, but it's really the basics. But there's a lot more, you know, that a LEED certified building can actually do to be responsible. And, right. Yeah. So, you know, it's really more focused on data, and both on the consumer's end as well as on the producer's end, right? To provide that data to people.
But how would you say, so for example, how does a consumer become smarter? How do they know? Because you will have companies which, you know, we've gone to trade shows where there'll be an entire section which says ethically sourced. Or there'll be companies which are fair trade in particular. So how does the consumer who wants to be conscious distinguish between these? How does one decide which way to go?
So some maybe simple, you know, indicators for, let's say, someone's gone to a trade show and they are saying that this is ethically sourced. So some questions that, you know, someone can ask would be how far did the material come from? So whatever you're making, the raw materials, where were they sourced from? Because a large amount of emissions actually occur during the supply chain. So if it is, let's say if a product is backward integrated, which means that everything, which all the raw materials which are going into making that product are sourced locally, are sourced from within that same production facility, that drastically cuts down the emissions. So that's a very simple thing they can say that, you know, where did the raw materials come from? Yeah. The second thing is that if there is a product which is an intensive, it uses power a lot, you know, so every product uses power, some more, some less. So the second question, where does the power come from? Yeah. So is it thermal? Is it electric? You know, is it renewable? Hydro? Is it solar? Because that's the other big, you know, bucket. And the third would be about the social, because, you know, it's not only about the air and the environment. It's about how people were treated, right? So you can ask the, you know, person, the trade fair can ask that, tell me about how your employees were treated. Tell me more about your company, that, you know, some policies about how, you know, are they happy people? It's very simple that, you know, but just ask them about the employees that, you know, tell me more about.
Right. So if I understand correctly, is it a more holistic approach to sustainability and it's not just one size fits all sort of answer to it?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad you bring this up because, you know, I teach the subject for the last many years and I always start with the history of sustainability. And it fascinates my students because, you know, it all started 200 years ago with food. Sustainability meant food security or the lack of it. And so definitely the meaning keeps changing. And so we need to snap ourselves out of what the current fad is, which I think now is about all about environment and waste, but it's really a holistic approach to being responsible. Like you said, whatever the product is, whichever context you're living in, if it's a country where there are 22% people who are below poverty line, we can't be only talking about the environment. You know, we have to be talking about the people and their well-being as well. Whereas if you're in a country like New Zealand or, you know, in Denmark, there's certain aspects which are sorted. And then you can focus more on, you know, on only the environmental aspects. But just to sum that up, it's, of course, it's the environment, it's people, but it's also ethics. It's financial sustainability as well, you know, it's resource efficiency, it's the sources of revenue being clean, you know, is it your legal, you know, your do you have any legal battles that are on or everything's all clean? So there are many aspects to doing things right.
I completely agree with you. And, you know, another term which has been popping up a lot, especially in the last couple of months when we've been doing so many live conversations. So we were talking to Richard Hutton, and he's been a crusader of sustainability as well. And he talks about greenwashing a lot. And I thought we could also deconstruct that work because it's important to know what's not right as well. What is your opinion on that?
Yeah, firstly, I love your question, Sisha. You know, greenwashing is something which is really needs to be taken very seriously. And in fact, it's more prevalent in Europe than in India yet. Because in India, you know, people have the uptake towards green is still, you know, nascent, right?
But
but in Europe, I mean, most things, almost all products are, you know, greenwashing essentially means saying that, oh, this is sustainable. This is green. This is environmentally friendly without any solid basis to it. And again, I will go down to data and the need for educational institutions to teach consumers to be sensitive and want data, to be able to understand and interpret data, as well as organizations to be reporting in terms of data. If you're saying, you know, it's like an advertisement, right? If you make if you put out an advertisement which is false, you'll be penalized for that, right? So similarly, even any product, if you're saying that we are green, you have to substantiate that with facts, with numbers. And to some extent, there has been some progress in the last few years, because what happened was that until 10 years ago, 10, 15 years ago, there were many different contesting ways of data reporting in sustainability. And now in the last 5, 6, 7 years, there is one specific approach. It's called the GRI framework for collecting data, calculating and reporting it. That's becoming increasingly unanimously accepted. It's been accepted in 30 different stock exchanges, 70 different countries. So which means that, which is a very good movement. So which means that if a juice bottle now says that I am, sustainable, if one company accepts the GRI way of reporting sustainability, that juice bottle will have to then report and, will have to put out the data that substantiates it being, sustainable. And to what extent is it sustainable?
That's interesting, because that means you're actually holding the brand or company responsible. And now there are certain universal guidelines to following to get that certification, as opposed to it, I think, being very fragmented as it was before.
Yeah.
Yes, because I've heard of, large brands which say, okay, we've created this lamp out of recycled plastic. But when I further read up a lot more about recycling plastic, sometimes that is not really the right approach to it, and that the emissions are a lot more. And so it was a little bit of a conflict between two designers, because one designer claimed that, yes, we're, using recycled plastic, et cetera, et cetera, vis-a-vis another person's opinion on that. So I think that's great, because then they sort of follow those guidelines and you kind of call out the false advertising in a certain sense.
Exactly.
So lovely. So we're waiting for those trademarks and those guidelines to come in then to, I think, clarify that matter.
It's actually in India too. The National Stock Exchange of India accepts GRI. It's just about companies, more and more companies to, start using that.
And enforcing it, right? It becomes a...
It needs to be mandatory.
Exactly. Because otherwise there's always a loophole, right? So what are some of the common challenges do you feel that brands face when trying to go sustainable? Because I feel like they have certain hurdles which they come across in terms of being profitable. How would you recommend they overcome these?
One thing is the knowledge about sustainability. So there are not too many courses and universities which teach sustainability. You might have one odd, master's in environmental sciences and stuff, and very specific. Courses on environment, but then the holistic approach that you're talking about and looking at corporate sustainability, big and small companies, it's very difficult to find people who know how to do this. So that's one big, challenge. Us professionals we've learned it on our own. I mean, I've worked at a bunch of places and through that read up and self-learning. And now, there are a few universities who are offering some courses. The second big impediment is the costs of reporting. So what I told you, because it's not mainstreamed yet, the collection of data and interpretation of data and all that. So there are a few consulting companies who know how to do this, and the costs are really inflated. They're shocking.
Right.
So, so for most companies, and especially for startups and smaller companies, then when they are anyways looking at a list of 10 priorities, this would be on the 11th or 12th, because there are these hefty prices which are really inflated. These are the two things. And third would be, it's not about one person kind of leading the charge of being responsible. That's a very traditional approach where you have one CSR guy, one CSR department. That's not how modern, organizations work. So it's every individual, has to be responsible in whatever they are doing. And often, when an organization is growing fast, making sure that sense of responsibility is percolated across the organization, and and everybody is taking ownership of initiating being responsible, as well as rolling out.
Right.
So that becomes a challenge, because it's not one person. Everybody has to do their bit.
I completely agree. But what are the solutions that a small firm can look at? Because like you said, that, when you're starting up or when you're a small business, unless you're using sustainability as a differentiating factor for what you do, it's, you know, on the last, like at the bottom rung of your list by and large. So how does someone sort of, what can they possibly do? Consulting firms, like you said, are very expensive. Are there any websites that someone could refer to? Is there, you know, because today you have a product designer, so would you recommend Craft as a, you know, as an alternative? What are the different ideas that a small company in design can look at? Yeah.
So actually being responsible as an organization, it's actually more lucrative for smaller companies than it is even for bigger. I mean, for bigger companies, it's great for stakeholders, but for a small company, it's essentially more lucrative to be responsible. Firstly, that knowledge gap, because it's small, so it's just easier to overcome that. And people, let's say there are 10 people in a company, you know, so they can bridge that knowledge gap and make sure everybody, you know, is on the same boat. It's not that it's difficult. It's just that it's not taught in our formal educational system. So now you have, like, for example, the World Bank has a bunch of free of cost, you know, training online courses, you know, on emissions and how to calculate and stuff. And it's not difficult. It's just you'll have to take the time out to do it because we were not taught that, you know, in schools and universities.
Exactly.
And then there's SOAS is doing a very good job. So this is a school in the UK. In London. SOAS is doing a very good job with having this whole department on sustainability and stuff. So they're good. Cambridge has a master's in sustainability. So all that. And then there is, I'm very involved with education for all the reasons that we are talking about. So I teach, you know, at Naropa, I teach like a bunch of entrepreneurs every year in Ladakh. There is a fellowship for climate action, started. And it's for entrepreneurs, it's for people, deans of universities. So that's a full age range of 14 to 64 in a cohort of 20, so where they can learn, what they need to learn. So I think for a small company, the bridging that knowledge gap becomes easier. Second is that nowadays investors increasingly are looking for responsible companies. I'll tell you why. Because responsible companies also make sure that stakeholders are happy. So the risk is reduced. Investors look at this. They are the leading light of this whole trend, the modern trend on sustainability. Because some of the earlier initiatives, like the Carbon Disclosure Project, it started 20 years ago, was initiated and led by investors, global investors, who wanted companies to report on this because they look at it as a risk mitigation, you know, instrument. So Europe, I would say almost every big investor would need to know about, you know, your sustainability parameters. So in terms of having your data right and saying that you're doing things responsibly actually attracts a lot more money to a small company. And many other reasons. So actually for startups, it's a much better idea.
In the materials that one uses, there's a huge trend of using vegan leather. So you have pineapple leather, you've got Malai leather, which is coming out of South India, which is quite interesting. We're noticing there are some 100% biodegradable rugs, which are coming out of mainstream brands. So it's interesting to see that. Also, a lot of furniture companies use reclaimed wood. So what are your thoughts on all of these materials? Is there any other new material that you've discovered? I know you spoke about the ash brick in the beginning of the conversation, but any others you would recommend, your opinion on these? How do we scale it up? How do we make it a normal norm that we use in everyday life?
So I'll probably unpack that question one by one. So on vegan leather, it's you know, some really creative sources of vegan leather is coming up, and you know, like pineapple is one, and there's so many more. It's always better than using traditional leather, but I think we still haven't found the sweet spot of durability there, of durability versus this.
Okay.
But it's excellent that, you know, you're coming up with people are coming up with these kind of options for leather. On biodegradable plastics, that I'll put my biggest bet on that, because especially for a country like India, because even 2 years ago, biodegradable plastics were very expensive, super expensive. What's happening now is that the costs again are going down. The challenge now, you know, some kind of standards, because if there's a company which is making biodegradable plastic, we don't know how they are making it, and we don't know whether it's actually biodegradable or not. So those standards are being put in place, and there's a company called Polymateria in the UK, which is working very hard with setting up UK British standards, bringing that to India. They're already speaking to the government. And why I would put my biggest bet on biodegradable plastics, because there's this whole informal economy, Isha, around plastics. And so using biodegradable plastics doesn't kill that, you know, so that other, like I said right at the beginning, we have to be very conscious about the social aspects, you know, in India and livelihood. And it continues to be a very cheap option as well, vis-a-vis a lot of these other sustainable materials, you know, with the price even going down even though, yeah. And then you talked about wood. Yes, you know, so essentially using wood, which was pre-loved and pre-used, and then, you know, using that again. That's always been something which people building, you know, which we know of. There, I think things like the floor of a house, you know, the wooden floor, that is always the cheapest. So, you know, if there's a house with a wooden floor and you're taking that and then making and using that to make, you know, whatever. So that's actually very cheap. There are certain parts of the house where when you want to, you know, take the wood and do something else with it and process it. And so sometimes the costs go high. But flooring is something which, you know, you really cut down costs. And then, of course, decoratively also, they look, you know, they look great as well.
The other conversation we were having was about craft and how that's also very sustainable, because a lot of the craft is handmade. So hence, you're not using electricity, you're not using technology per se, especially a lot of the rugs which come out of India and which are being exported. A lot of them use, their carbon footprint is really low in terms of the making of the product.
Yeah. See, I think, Isha, I think in terms of using traditional ways of doing things and making those products, I think in India, that trend is there. So when you talk of sustainable fashion, the layman's language of sustainable fashion, or even the designers, is that. Like, if you say sustainable fashion, they won't talk about any kind of reuse, you know, loop, circular loop in there. They talk about look, you know, sourcing things locally and traditional ways. So I feel there we've done quite well, better than a lot of other places. And I hope that trend continues, you know, that I hope that trend.
I think the reuse goes under, I think, a DIY category in India. You know, we look at that as something, you know, which you've seen on Pinterest, and you've sort of taken something, created something else out of it.
Yeah, that's how far we've reached there in that.
The other thing is, I know you've been at the forefront of, you know, our whole COVID crisis in India. And one of the most remarkable things that you've done is created the cardboard beds for all the temporary hospitals that you all built. And also you all created testing centers out of auto rickshaws. So what inspired you to do that? And, you know, how did this idea, how did you conceptualize this entire idea?
So again, for me, people are very important, you know, so it's not just the environment, but making sure that people are healthy and alive. So when the pandemic hit India, you know, so actually I was in Paris. We live a few months in Paris every year. We were at that time in Paris. And in March, we came back, and at the airport, national airport, it was loudspeakers were, you know, it was just all over social distancing. And I've written this whole book on equality and, you know, all that. And that's something which I work a lot on. And I knew it that the social distancing won't work in a country where, you know, one in six people live in slums in cities.
Right. Yeah.
So what happened was that I started thinking about solutions very early on when there were just 300, 400 cases of COVID in India.
Right.
And I've set up a research center at one of our clients. It's a university, Ananth University. It's a design university. So I've set up a research center there. And we were working on this mega report on vacant houses. So 7.5% of India's housing stock is vacant. No one's living there. In a country which has, 20 million housing gap. And so that's where it occurred to me that, you know, why can't we convert these large halls and large, you know, spaces into hospitals? So we quickly got to work and put together a proposal to give to the Prime Minister. And we did that. But frankly, Isha, I thought that no one's ever going to read that also. So simultaneously, I started reaching out to some friends who are in politics and stuff. So, you know, Milind Deora in Bombay and Anil Anthony in Kerala. And they managed to get me spaces through local government bodies. And I got funding from here and there, from, you know, under the university and everything. And we set up two of them, one in Kerala and one in Bombay. And after that, every 2 weeks, we were coming up with a new hospital. So we ended up in 4 months making 11 COVID hospitals across 5 states and all out of cardboard beds, because the first one in Kerala, we did it with normal beds. And when we were doing it in Bombay and when people started showing interest in this, I knew that we had to scale up. And if you want to scale up, then these normal beds were costing $3,000 a piece. And I put together a few people to brainstorm, and very quickly we just started thinking about different materials, and we thought of laminated corrugated cardboard. So at that time it was like complete lockdown, so even experimenting with that material was very difficult. But we made our first bed, and then after that we got into production capacity of 500 beds per week, and each bed costed little around 400 rupees. So the difference is 3,000 to 400. And because we were doing it on a not-for-profit basis, so they were really, you know, it was really cheap. And we put a lamination on these beds so that it's actually water resistant. We sent 3 beds to Kerala. Just, there was the first 3 beds, we sent them to Kerala. And at that time, monsoon, there's pre-monsoons. And they got drenched in water and they were still standing. And then we made, you know, they were the same material, side tables, which otherwise cost 2,000. So it's something called a medicine box in hospitals. Correct. And the same utility, we made it into specific types of like a stable. A table that was 250 rupees. And then we even made these separators, you know, between the beds. And that costed us a little south of 800 bucks. And otherwise, there's a wide range of these separators. And you asked about the auto rickshaws. While, you know, we were scaling up with these hospitals, what was happening is that I felt that we need to test more. You know, testing is what was most important. And initially, I started thinking about mobile testing. But then, you know, my conversations in with people who work in this area, you know, plugged into various of these groups, was that testing was very difficult initially, if you remember. It was very difficult to, you know, get people tested.
Correct.
And then the fatalities were really rising. So then I started thinking about mobile ways of using mobility towards just bringing down the fatalities. How do you just bring down the fatalities? Forget, you know, anything else. So that's when, you know, ambulances, so a mobile ambulance. And then when we came down to thinking about how do you make an affordable and highly effective ambulance? The greatest cost in any ambulance, a commercial ambulance, is the cost of the vehicle. So if you bring that cost down, and or the auto rickshaw is the cheapest vehicle. So we took these cargo auto rickshaws, the cheapest vehicle. And that just brought down the cost of an ambulance like by 1/10 of the cost. So that's how those came. And that also we said, we made them and they're running in 2 states, in Maharashtra and in Gujarat.
Wow, that's incredible. No, everyone is talking about your cardboard beds. So I know what a, you know, absolute game changer that was at a time like that. And these were all completely made in India at that point, I'm guessing.
Oh, yeah. These were made in one godown in Rajkot, where one of the professors, Dhaval Monani, was like administering, and the students, we got them to, you know, do things. My team was like up, like moving trucks in the lockdown, completely very
Indian. Yeah, like all local, don't worry about 100%.
Those were some days.
So I'm just going to end with one really simple question is, what would be your 10 simple sustainable ideas for 2021? Very simple, basic, whatever you would possibly recommend, 10 of them.
One would be consume less, like minimal. That just changes everything. Number 2 is ask questions when you hear somebody saying this is sustainable. Ask questions.
Okay.
Number three would be that think about sustainability from an affordability perspective. So what is it that you can do, which is affordable and sustainable? You'll come up with so many ideas yourself. Number four is buy good quality things because they last longer. Buy fewer good quality things, take care of them, and they will last longer. My fifth one would be try to use public transport, try to walk, try to buy local, just try to make your local ecosystem work. You know, just go take a walk to your local sabzi market and buy, or, you know, it will give you exercise, and that fuel, you know, is just lesser. It's good for health. Your number seven would be teach your child to be responsible.
Educate
them, you know, so don't depend on the schools and universities to teach your child. You can begin the movement of education at home, you know, yourself. Number eight would be, don't just be a laptop activist. You know, it's not just about being outrage, you know, having an outrage. Channel that energy of laptop activism into...
I like this one.
Into everyday minimalism, you know, everyday little bit. That will actually, you know, add more. Number nine would be share an idea. So be constructive, be a solutionary. You know, if you have a solution, if you have ideas, be constructive and share that, you know, so others can benefit from, you know, from that idea. And number 10 would be, I think, some of the things that we talked about. If you're making a house, if you're making like big ticket items, just make sure that the materials, you know, the materials that you're using are sustainable. You know, if you're buying a piece of clothing, what goes into that? Is that sustainable? So think about the materials which goes into any purchase of yours, and then think about if that's been sustainable.
That's perfect. I loved laptop activists. I feel there's so many people guilty of that. We have a lot of guilty people for that one. So that was great. I think those ideas are brilliant, and hopefully our listeners are going to use those and apply them for this year. But thank you so much for doing this. It was absolutely wonderful.
My pleasure.
And so enlightening. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Isha, for inviting me. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in. This brings us to the end of another episode of the Design Pataki podcast. I hope you enjoyed today's conversation. We'll see you in our next episode. Until then, head over to www.designpataki.com for stories on Indian and international design, art and architecture. Take care and see you soon.